CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Cuba. Breaking news from the administration and Reuters. The United States is expected to soon announce initial steps as part of the Biden administration's review of Cuba policy and in response to Havana's crackdown on the biggest street protests in decades. The senior official's comments further signaled that the president was not ready to soften the U.S. approach after his predecessor rolled back a historic Obama-era detente. The official, speaking to Reuters on condition of anonymity, made clear that the Biden administration is still seeking ways to ease the humanitarian plight of the Cuban people. I welcome Roseanne Lake, Cuba correspondent for The Economist magazine. Roseanne, a very good day to you. As I understand it, the plight, the humanitarian plight, is a long time coming. And in your presentation at The Economist, you named two major factors. One is the connection to Venezuela and to Russia that has subsidized the Cuban economy for many years. And another is leadership in Cuba. I put these two things in front of us because they're external factors to what is apparently an internal matters we're all living with, the pandemic and also food security because of a poor sugar harvest. So let's begin with the subsidies that have come from Venezuela and also Russia over the years. They have been turned off. Is that correct? And is there any prospect of them being re-engaged in order to provide some relief for the Cuban people? Good day to you.
Good day, John. Thank you very much for having me on the show. With regards to Russia and Venezuela, those used to be, you know, cards that Cuba had up its sleeve for difficult moments like this one. But yes, they have been turned off. Russia kind of ended, well, you know, we're talking when at the fall of the Soviet Union, right? Prior to the fall of the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union was essentially Cuba's benefactor. I've spoken to people who say Fidel could make a call and what he needed, you know, would be delivered. They were very generous because there were political ideologies that wanted to be mutually supported. And that was a big source of income for Cuba, income and resources. But of course, after the fall of the Soviet Union, Cuba falls into what is euphemistically known as the special period, the periodo especial, and goes through the worst economic crises that it's had in a very long time, somewhat comparable to the one it's living through today. And then, of course, Venezuela becomes another benefactor. And it's not entirely fair to say benefactor because Cuba does, you know, has sent doctors to Venezuela over time. But in exchange, Cuba receives very heavily subsidized crude oil that it then refined and sold, exported all over the world to the tune of several billion dollars a year. And of course, that pipeline has dried up of oil, which means that the foreign reserves that Cuba is able to gain for refining that oil and exporting it to other places have also dwindled considerably, leaving it very much in the red and in a very precarious economic situation, even prior to the kickoff of the pandemic.
Yes. And so now, given that there's no likelihood of those subsidies to be reengaged, I turn to your citing of leadership. I do not know anything other than the name Miguel Diaz-Canel, the new leader of Cuba after the retirement, the death of Fidel Castro and the retirement of Raul Castro. Who is he? What does he represent to the revolution, to the Cuban people?
Well, yes, he's now on paper the most powerful man in Cuba because he is head of the Communist Party. He has been president of Cuba since 2019. So when we say new leader, he's actually been around for some time. He's certainly, you know, not new by Cuban standards when people tend to stay in power for a couple of decades. But he was a very, I guess, neutral, safe choice on the part of the Castros. It almost seems like he had been groomed to take over Cuba and just sort of, you know, rule in a way that wouldn't be too radical. He wouldn't change up the script too much. He was a safe choice. He's from Santa Clara. He worked his way up as first secretary of, you know, the provincial party of Santa Clara. He was known as being reliable and competent and, you know, didn't do things. He really didn't veer too much from the script. He's the first person who is not a Castro to leave Cuba since 1959, which is significant. And he was also born after the Communist Revolution. I would believe he was born in 61, which means that he didn't live through it. And he doesn't sort of get the gold stars that people get who lived through it because he didn't have to cut his teeth, you know, fighting for the country. Of course, he was a member of the armed forces and sort of worked his way up through that system. But he also, what a lot of Cubans notice, he lacks charisma, right? Fidel, for all of his flaws, was incredibly charismatic and was known to be able to just, you know, captivate people with the way he spoke. There was a maleconazo, a huge, you know, a protest that is being compared to the protest that we saw last Sunday. When that happened in the 90s, you know, it's the story is sort of told that Fidel showed up and started speaking and was able to calm the crowds. Miguel Díaz-Canel does not have that power, and he's also not the type of person to go out, venture into the middle of the crowds to placate them. So he's just a very different leader, and people don't forgive him as much as they might a Castro, just given the name and the history and the aura around them.
In The Economist, in response to the protests about medicine, about healthcare, about food, for heaven's sakes, wide-ranging, a patria y vida, I believe was the call, patriotism and life. The quote in The Economist is that Miguel Díaz-Canel said, "Revolutionaries to the street." And there are anecdotes, plenty of them, you've seen them, Roseanne, about brutality, even death because of the repression of the regime, calling out their heavy-handed response, the state security and bully boys. Now, is that Miguel Díaz-Canel? Does he have a reputation for being a brute when in response to protests?
I wouldn't say that's just Díaz-Canel. I would say that the faction of the Communist Party that is currently terrified, right? We know that a government doesn't respond with repression and brutality like the Cuban government has unless it's just terrified. And that's one of the things that you can reproach the Cuban government for most these days, because it's just not, I mean, as one of my sources said, you know, instead of listening to the people, instead of listening to what their calls are for, and this is not the first protest that has happened. This is the biggest by far, in a very long time. But back in November, we started to see the beginnings of, you know, people who were discontented with how their government was responding with their needs. And at the time, they weren't calling for a change of government. They were just calling for dialogue. And at the time, they were also called mercenaries. They were called terrorists. The state-run media apparatus, you know, ganged up on them. And the government itself, as one of my sources said, you know, closed up like an oyster and didn't give them the time of day. And I think, you know, if that sort of is allowed to build up over time, people start to get very frustrated and you know, and take to the streets in greater numbers. And instead of maybe asking for a dialogue, they realize that that's futile. And so they ask for other things like freedom and patria vida and, you know, start to suggest that they would like a new government because their current one doesn't listen to them. And that's unfortunately been a tactic that, you know, is not unique to Díaz-Canel. It's not new under his mandate. This is how you know, dissidence is dealt with in Cuba, with repression, with force. And we've seen it in very, very alarming numbers. And it may be one of the things that I know that it must be one of the things that the Biden administration is thinking about heavily in terms of, you know, how they plan to respond to Cuba. Looking at, you know, how these human rights abuses are happening is certainly something that is probably very top of mind as they consider how they plan to respond.
I recall last fall reporting about protests from artists in, I think, a particular neighborhood of Havana, is my memory. And it was set to songs, and it was they were young people with a band or a series of singing events. Do I remember correctly? It all seems quite romantic and certainly not to lead to a existential crisis for the regime. How did it get out of hand?
Ooh, well, that was a much smaller protest or manifestation, right? You had about 300 people, and you're absolutely right. It was a movement linked to the neighborhood of San Ysidro in Havana. I guess one thing that's important to distinguish here is that we're talking about different groups, right? The Movimiento San Ysidro is largely artists and musicians and intellectuals, and it was a movement born of wanting the government to not censor their work. Obviously, the people that took to the streets in Cuba last Sunday on July 11th were looking for something different. These were not all artists and intellectuals and musicians, but there is this idea that seeing these artists and intellectuals and musicians take to the streets in about a crowd of about 300, seeing that news and then seeing what the response was from the government, not a nice one, how one of them was taken from his home in the middle of the night, and he was left in Calixto Garcia Hospital for a very long time, on hunger strike, everything else. He was on the hunger strike. They didn't put him on a hunger strike. I think seeing this kind of emboldened people. It made them think, we don't necessarily need to tell our government that we want greater artistic freedoms because maybe we're not artists or maybe we're not this, but we want greater social freedoms or greater economic freedoms. And, over time, and then, of course, you have other factors that contribute, right? You have to consider that education and healthcare are two of the pillars of the communist revolution. And right now, both healthcare especially are in a very dire situation. I was speaking with a Cuban doctor yesterday who said, I would almost say that the indirect effects of the pandemic are more critical than the direct ones. And by that, he meant, yes, of course, the coronavirus case and the death count have been very very, very terrible. But at the same time, the coronavirus has meant that the measures that the government has had to take to control the spread of the virus have been devastating, right? You close airports and you shut down the tourism industry. These are two things that are critical for the survival of everyday Cubans. As he pointed out, half of the things that his parents consume on a daily basis, soap, shampoo, coffee, just basic things like that, are things that he brings in from Brazil or things that his brother brings in. They both live abroad, right? And so when the airplanes, when flights are no longer coming in and those basic things are not coming in for a lot of Cubans, that puts a strain on what's available. And you also have this incredibly important network of what are called mulas, right? Mules, who are people, who work in the black market. They travel to Mexico, to Panama, sometimes as far as Russia. They buy a bunch of things, household goods, non-perishable foods. They then resell on the black market. Those people haven't been able to travel. And because the Cuban government is consistently incapable of buying enough of these things to then sell in Cuban grocery stores or, Cuban stores, they just don't exist, which means queues and shortages. And when you lack hygienic supplies, that, of course, causes greater stress on the system. But most importantly, he says, things like painkillers and antibiotics and insulin and asthma medication, those things are nowhere to be found. So these indirect effects, this collateral damage of the measures that needed to be taken as a result of the pandemic, he thinks have actually been the most damaging. And of course, when you live in a country where the pillar of your revolution is healthcare, where you can say to yourself, I may never be able to afford a fancy vacation, but at least I have the guarantee of good healthcare. When that guarantee is brutally eroded before your eyes, well, of course, it's going to make you question your fidelity to it, right? So I think it was those secondary effects that have been building over time, the shortage of food, the shortage of medicine, the endlessly long queues. And then on top of it, this sort of repression of people who are calling for very simple things, artistic freedoms. When that piles up before your eyes, well, certainly it makes you think. And if you have to, take to the streets with a pan and a spoon and start banging them and saying Libertad or Patria Vida, well, you do it.
What is to be done? Roseanne Lake of The Economist magazine, the Cuba correspondent. When we come back, the 19th century question in the 21st, what is to be done? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.